Random House Audiobooks presents After the Fall by Suzanne Summers. Read for you by the author.
After the fall, how I picked myself up, dusted myself off, and started all over again. What could be worse than losing the number one television show in America? Not losing it. That's right. Had I continued playing Chrissy Snow on Three's Company, the humongous hit TV show, I would not be the Suzanne I am today, and that's a person I'm happy to be. I had been moving full speed in America's fast lane. Life was great. Nothing could stop me now, I thought. Money was plentiful. Work was coming at me like bullets on an artillery range. I could pick and choose. I was dancing in the big time. People called me Miss Summers. Crowded restaurants magically had the best table available. Theater tickets were no problem either, nor were hotel reservations or hair appointments. Crowded doctor's offices would always fit me in for an appointment when it was convenient for me. There was no waiting in lines for movies or sitting in crowded airport lounges. I no longer even needed to carry a purse. Somehow, somewhere, magically, someone would appear to take care of my needs. I didn't ask for any of this special treatment. It just came to me. Then one day, while my life was speeding along that highway, someone opened the back door of the car and kicked me out. Suddenly, I found myself sitting on the side of the road all alone, watching a cloud of dust as the car sped on without me. As quickly as it all came, it was over. I was no longer America's darling. Suddenly, I was no longer on the number one television show in the country, so I wasn't bringing in any profits. And when you don't bring in profits, the door slammed shut. The friends I had made along the way were suddenly too busy to see me. The open doors of the network executives closed in my face. The party invitations dried up. I had not understood that the invitations, the champagne, the scripts, the dinner invites, the open doors, and the friends were about business. This is the way it's done in Hollywood. The line between business and friendship is deliberately blurred. The pros, the ones who endure, understand this. It's the naive ones, like myself, the new hot one on the block who get it confused and take it personally. Today, 20 years later, I'm grateful. I really am. If I hadn't lost everything, I never would have had to do the work to bring myself back. I'm not talking about success anymore, although that came with it. I'm talking about the emotional work that helped me find the self-esteem to be the person I am today. It's an ongoing journey that has brought and continues to bring me peace of mind, serenity, and happiness with myself and the new life I have created. As always, to explain where I am today, it's necessary to tell you the story of where I've been. "Put your heads between your knees," the pilot screamed. "We're going to try to make a landing in the water." Two island ladies sitting across from us started wailing, "Oh Lord, we're going to die. Oh Lord, we're going to die." I could see the black waters of the Caribbean approaching closer and closer out the window of our small twin-engine Fairchild. The engines labored against the hurricane-force winds. Bam! Another air pocket. We dropped hundreds of feet once again. "Oh, God," I yelled. The screams of the 18 petrified passengers pierced the blackness of the night. "I don't want my life to be over," I thought. My poor little boy, Bruce, was expecting me to be home that night. He had been staying at my parents' house while Alan and I were on vacation. I knew Bruce was anxious to get back to his own room in our house and away from his grandfather's drunken, violent mood swings. The cabin was illuminated once again. Lightning was all around us. Rain poured in slanted sheets against the flimsy windows of our small plane. "I love you, Alan," I said through tears. "I've never felt this way about anyone in my life. I don't want it to be over." "I love you too, Suzanne," Alan said softly. The plane jerked violently. Alan put his arm around my back protectively while our heads rested between our knees in crash position. "We're going down, we're going down," the pilot yelled through his microphone. The plane was descending. It was out of control. The winds bouncing our little craft like a kickball. I prepared for the worst. Alan's hand wrapped around mine, stopping the blood from flowing. The numbness in my fingers mirrored my fear. To believe you are about to die stops all feeling. You just wait for the inevitable. Then bang, bong. We hit ground. Ground. Ground, not water. We made it. We were alive. Bruce would have a mother. Alan and I would have a life together. We hugged each other tearfully. We had made it through one of the worst storms in the history of the Caribbean. We had been spared. The next day, January 2nd, 1977, exactly one day after surviving that near-fatal plane crash, I returned to Los Angeles via San Francisco to get Bruce and received a phone call from my manager, Bonnie. She said in her side-of-the-mouth, Runyon-esque way, "Listen, I got a call from ABC for a new show they're doing called Three's Company, and they seem really interested in you." "I don't know," I said reluctantly. "I almost died last night, and I've been doing a lot of thinking. I just can't do this anymore." "What do you mean you almost died last night?" "Oh, it was terrible," I told her. "It was the first time it had snowed in the Bahamas in 50 years. Our small plane was struck by lightning and was damaged. Coming that close to death got me thinking. I didn't sleep at all last night. I kept asking myself, what am I doing with my life? My career is stuck. I'm weary from the constant rejection. They tell me I'm either too short, too tall, not funny enough, too busty or not busty enough. All I hear is what I'm not. Let's just give it up, okay? I'm not going to make it in this business. I've been going after an impossible dream." "Well, maybe you'll live for a reason," Bonnie said thoughtfully. "Maybe God has big plans for you, Suzanne. Don't give up now. We've worked so hard, and I swear, they seem really interested. Why don't you try one more time?" "All right," I sighed. "One last time, and then that's it, okay?" I put the phone down and began the routine. Bruce was at school, so I had plenty of time to go to the interview and be back before he got home. I washed my long blonde hair and put on a little makeup. I jumped into my Chevy Vega and drove to Century City, the West Coast headquarters of ABC Television. Normally, I would have been extremely nervous walking into such an intimidating situation, but compared to what I experienced the night before, this was nothing. Fred Silverman was a middle-aged guy with a round face and intense blue eyes. He gave off powerful and impatient vibes, kind of scary, but at the same time impressive. I could tell he was in charge, and I found that trait appealing. He was sitting at a big desk in an even bigger windowed office that overlooked Century City. The room was filled with what looked like a sea of gray suits. I don't know, maybe 20 men, all seemingly dressed alike. A young brunette woman was sitting on the couch. She was dressed casually in contrast to the severity of the others. I wondered who she was. Fred was smiling. No one else was. This was serious business. A lot was at stake for the network. Their new show, Three's Company, had been given a green light if they could find the right blonde to complete the trio. They had already hired Joyce DeWitt and John Ritter to star. Two pilots had already been done with two other blonde actresses, but the chemistry wasn't right. "This is Joyce DeWitt," I was told. "She'll be playing Janet." "Ah, so that's who she is," I thought. Joyce was calm and had a lot of confidence, and I wondered how she had gotten like that. Joyce and I read two pages, then another three pages. The room laughed, but only if Fred laughed. Fred would go, "Ha, ha, ha," and then the sea of gray suits would go, "Ha, ha, ha." This is weird, I thought. I had no experience in the business, so I didn't realize that millions of dollars were at stake. "Well, thank you very much," Fred said to me, and I knew I was dismissed. I'd been through so many tryouts, seemingly hundreds over the last several years, that I never really expected to get the job. Today was probably no different, I thought, which was fine with me. I wanted to move on and make a change in my life. I hoped I could figure out how to develop a regular cooking school in my home that, in time, could work itself into something not only lucrative, but enjoyable and creative as well. I actually felt great that I had something new to focus on. The constant rejection of auditions had become almost intolerable. I was preoccupied when I walked in the front door of the apartment I shared with my then-boyfriend, Alan Hamill, and my son, Bruce, who was 11 years old. Alan and I had been in love for 8 years. In 1977, I had moved to Los Angeles from Sausalito to be with him. There were no guarantees of marriage, but there was a sincere desire to try to make it as a couple. Times were tough. I was having financial difficulties from lack of work, and Alan was trying to bounce back financially from his divorce and dealing with all the confused feelings that came from sharing his life with my son, while his two children lived in his former home with his ex-wife. All three of our children were anxious and upset. My son did not like sharing me with Alan after having had me all to himself. Alan was having a hard time warming up to Bruce out of the guilt of not living with his own kids. I loved Alan and was willing to do whatever was necessary to spend my life with him, but I was aware we had a lot of problems to sort out if we were going to mend the hurt that swirled around us. I had never in my life met a man like Alan Hamill. From that first moment in December 1968 at the KGO studios in San Francisco, it was as though an electric charge went through my body. He was hosting a national television show for ABC called The Anniversary Game, and I had been hired for a day as a prize model. In an instant, I knew I had to be with Alan, if only one time, just to know I had experienced merging with another so completely. That is the power of kindred souls. As a person, I felt emotionally supported by Alan in a way I had never experienced before. He became my lover and my mentor. His thinking was not clouded with limitations. Long before it was popular, he thought that anything in life is possible if you believe in yourself. Alan was somehow sent to teach me to believe in myself, which was no small achievement. My childhood had left me damaged, with no sense of self-worth. My love affair with Alan was the central focus of my life. I was constantly juggling my mothering of Bruce with my passion for Alan. The other few men in my life prior to Alan always took a back seat to my mothering responsibilities. Except for one brief relationship when Bruce was a toddler, no man was ever asked to spend time in my home because of Bruce, nor did I ever date until after Bruce's bedtime. Our home belonged to Bruce and me. We were each other's worlds. My childhood family did not fit into this life of my making either. I felt judged by them, real or imagined, that they perceived my getting pregnant before marriage was a problem I had created for myself, which was true, and now I would have to live with the consequences and figure it out. The exception was my mother, who has always been my connection to safety. I had moved away from my hometown of San Bruno, California in 1964, mainly to stop feeling the judgment and the whispers of the locals. I had married my boyfriend, Bruce Summers, when I was 18 and pregnant. In the 2 short years we were married, I was miserable and blamed him for our predicament. I felt that for both of us, youth had been cut short and our individual dreams would never be realized. What had been fun as girlfriend and boyfriend was now a new life of responsibility we were not yet ready to assume. We had no money, so paying the rent and putting food on the table kept us both in a constant state of panic, hardly conducive to starting a life together. Bruce was a nice guy with an easy laugh. He excelled academically and had dreams of becoming a lawyer when he finished his studies at the University of San Francisco. He was 2 years older than me, but his 20 years were not sufficient to prepare him for fatherhood and marriage. 2 years after Bruce and I were married, we divorced. Once again, I was the subject of scandal, first having to get married because I was pregnant, and now getting divorced. But the union had been so wrong that we both felt it was better to get out now rather than later. I was the first person I knew who was divorced. It just wasn't done at that time. It was 1967, which is an eternity ago by today's behavioral standards. I walked away from the gossip and the judgment to begin again and moved with my son across the bay to Sausalito. Life is not easy for a young divorcee with a child and no support system, financial or emotional. At times I felt deep despair and loneliness, but every morning the shining face of my adorable child would look into mine and give me the strength to get through another day. I'd never had a friend like my son, Bruce. It was a relationship without complications, founded on unconditional love. Had I not been financially destitute, I truly would not have needed anything else in my life. I foraged for work to pay for the necessities and somehow eked out a living by modeling for small-time accounts. Then one day, without warning, I found myself locked eye-to-eye with Alan Hamill. Now my focus was divided between the two greatest love affairs imaginable. Both wanted all of me, and in that the struggle began. Alan was married, but the marriage was coming to an end. He and his wife had drifted apart over the years because of Alan's traveling and long absences. His children were a big part of his reason for staying. He had been able to coast in the relationship because he had never been seriously emotionally involved with another woman, and returning home to the excited faces of his kids, he said, made living this way worthwhile. "Things are fine the way they are. It would be no different even if I were divorced," he kept explaining, hoping I would find this arrangement agreeable so he would not be forced to make difficult changes. I was not evolved yet as a woman and had not even considered the immorality of my participation in this union with Alan. Had I been an accountable person at this time, I would have insisted our relationship be put on hold until his marriage was officially over. But I didn't. To avoid taking the next step, Alan protected his feelings by denying the fact that my life included my son. If he could deny Bruce's inconvenient existence, Alan could protect himself emotionally, so he had no interest in knowing Bruce on any level. I was sure I had no future with Alan, so I kept the two separate, never forcing them to acknowledge each other. I loved Alan so much that to have him on these terms was better than not having him at all. In the darkness of my lonely nights, I was filled with guilt. It was wrong, yet I couldn't stop. It was beyond sex. It was a feeling of being comfortable with him, as though we had known each other all our lives. I couldn't, and wouldn't, ask him to change his life for fear I would drive him away. For 3 years we lived this way, Alan with his double life, Bruce and I with our private lives, and Alan and I with our love affair. Three distinct and completely separate lives that never crossed over their invisible barriers. Then one day Alan told me he was ending his marriage officially. I had never asked him to and had not expected it. Suddenly there was a future. I allowed myself to dream of Alan, Bruce, Alan's children, Leslie and Stephen, and me as one big happy family. I knew this would take a lot of work, but we could do it. It was my dream. In my naivete, I thought we'd be able to smoothly roll over to the next phase. I had not counted on the children's right to object. They didn't want new parents, nor could they see where they fit into our passionate twosome. We each threaten the other's children by our very existence. But relationships are about steps, and this was the next inevitable step, like it or not. We were parents, and our children were integral parts of our lives. When I first met Alan's daughter, Leslie, who was 4 years older than my son, I felt as though I was being inspected at a meat market. She did not smile, but instead looked at me warily and suspiciously. Somewhere in that moment, I imagine she must have decided that no one was going to make her feel anything she did not want to feel. Leslie was born into an idyllic life. As a child, she was a free spirit, a very happy baby with a great sense of humor. She lived with her parents and her nanny in a beautiful old Victorian mansion in Rosedale, the best address in the heart of Toronto. It was a life surrounded by loving grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins, all of whom described her glowingly as smart as a whip, unique, adorable, lovable, and incredibly artistic and creative. When she was 3, Leslie's brother Stephen was born. He was a gentle child, much less outgoing than Leslie, but like his sister, he was artistically inclined, encouraged by their mother, herself an outstanding artist. This happy life continued until Stephen was 6 years old and Leslie was 9. It was then that Alan decided to move his family to California. He had been wanting to move to Los Angeles for several years. It was a choice that was to change his family dynamics forever. Los Angeles is so different from Toronto. For the same price as Alan's Rosedale mansion, he was able to find a typical California home in a middle-class neighborhood. It was nice, but hardly comparable to the elegance and grandeur of the house they had left behind. Alan and his wife were growing further and further apart, and Leslie and Stephen were feeling the tension in the house. They were starting to act out and rebel. When Daddy was home, there was this strained silence between their once-loving parents. Stephen and Leslie were too young to fathom the meaning of what was happening, yet sensitive enough to know it wasn't something good. To confront their reality would bring about change, and change was overwhelming to entertain. By the time I came into the picture in 1968, my impression of Alan's marriage was one of two people under one roof living separate lives. Knowing this helped to ease my guilt, but I was grateful when his marriage dissolved officially. After Alan and I decided to try living together, our difficulties began. For the first time in our relationship, we were arguing a lot. We weren't used to the daily drudgery of rent, bills, and groceries. The child support payments I needed to help support Bruce never came, and I received no alimony. I couldn't find work, and Alan was trying to start a new career in America. We took our frustration out on each other. I guess you do always hurt the one you love. From observing Alan's behavior with others over the years, I knew he was a very controlling person, but I never realized just how controlling until we shared a home. He wanted me to do everything his way. I had recently ended 3.5 years of life-saving therapy sessions that had helped me understand my childhood and its effects on me. But now, living with Alan and watching him ignore my son set me back emotionally. I didn't know how to deal with the situation. When Alan and I would fight, I would run to Bruce's room and sequester myself. Alan denied Bruce's existence to the degree that he rarely set foot in the door of Bruce's room unless Stephen was visiting and the two boys were playing together. But running to Bruce as my confidant created a new dynamic for both of us. In my pain, Bruce became my protector, which was too much pressure for a small boy. I was lonely, I needed a shoulder to cry on. And Bruce felt happy to be able to provide that comfort, but it created false hopes for him. It opened up his thinking. Perhaps Mom will leave Alan, and then we can go back to our previous normal lives. Each time Alan and I made up became a disappointment for Bruce. But what could he say? He just stuffed the feeling down with all the rest of these new thoughts, presuming eventually it would all go away. I was experiencing familiar feelings and depression. I had allowed the chaos of my childhood to follow me into my adult life. If Alan was happy, I was happy. If Alan was upset, I was upset. If Bruce was sad, so was I. If Leslie and Stephen felt threatened, so did I. I thought I had entered this part of my life well. I thought I was all healed. Why did I feel like such a mess? I was losing me again. I didn't realize that control was the issue. I wanted equality, equally shared power in my relationship with Alan. It is so easy to look back and see it with clarity today, but when you are living inside the vortex of a storm, it's very difficult to find your way out. Back home after my interview with Fred Silverman, I washed the makeup from my interview face back to my usual everyday shiny clean skin. I put on my favorite faded Levi's and a t-shirt. Bruce would be home from school soon, and I was looking forward to walking down to the beach with him. I'd actually almost forgotten about the auditions at ABC. But as I was hanging up the blouse I had worn to the audition, the phone started ringing. "Hello," I said calmly. Oh, my God," Bonnie screamed through the receiver. "You got it! You got it!" For a moment, I couldn't figure out what she was talking about. Then comprehension sank in. I was speechless. It was beyond my wildest dreams, and there was no way, at that moment, I could ever have known that the course of my life would be changed forever. The oncoming weeks were a frenzy of publicity photos, wardrobe fittings, interviews, and rehearsals. There was a buzz in the TV industry about Three's Company. For the era, this program was considered racy. The show was about two girls and a guy sharing an apartment. Joyce DeWitt played Janet Wood, who worked in a florist shop, and I played Chrissy Snow, an office typist secretary. The two girls shared an apartment together until they had a party one night. Upon awakening the next morning, they found Jack Tripper, a student chef, played by John Ritter, asleep in the bathtub. Because they had an extra bedroom they weren't using, and they liked the idea of additional help with the rent, they agreed to let Jack move in. The girls told the landlord that Jack was gay so the landlord wouldn't be upset. Therein lay the premise for Three's Company. I was starting to understand why everyone had been so nervous that day in Fred Silverman's office. The show was due to start production, and they had been short one star. Star. What a strange new identity. I had done nothing to deserve it, yet all the magazines were asking my opinion and calling me Miss Summers. It was pretty hard to feel worthy of all the attention. But this new life was a great distraction from the personal problems Alan and I were having with blending our families. Alan was genuinely happy for me. Jealousy is not one of his traits. "You're going to be so great in this part," he kept saying. He had been in the entertainment business for many years and continually encouraged me in the beginning weeks to calm my overworked nerves. In retrospect, I can see that this new development in my life was very hard on Bruce. Not only was he having to share me with Alan, but now he would also have to share with my new active career. Being my darling boy, he kept his happy face and pretended everything was okay in order to make it easier for me. The price for pretending would have to be paid later, but for now, I thought things were good for him. The first pickup for Three's Company was only 6 episodes because it was a mid-season replacement, but we were practically assured of a full pickup of 24 episodes starting in the fall of 1977 because of our sensational ratings. Nevertheless, I worried that if somehow something went wrong, I would lose this incredible momentum. I had been paying attention to the successes of Jay Bernstein, the famed publicist-turned-manager who had catapulted Farrah Fawcett from a spokeswoman for toothpaste into an icon adored by fans all over the world. I felt that if I could hire Jay to be my publicist, he could use the success of Three's Company to get me publicity. The only problem was that Jay's fee was $2,500 a month, and I really couldn't afford it. "I'll make you a deal," I said nervously to Jay at our first meeting in his office. "I will give you all the money I'm making for this series, which is $2,750 a week for the entire first 6 weeks of the series, except for my manager's fee, which goes to Bonnie. In return, I'd like you to make sure that people know who I am. If for some reason this show doesn't make it, I want to be visible enough to use this opportunity to get my next job." It meant Jay would begin working for me during the summer months that bridged the gap between the first 6 episodes and the start of the fall season. I turned over all 6 paychecks to him, knowing I was gambling with the only big money, by my financial standards anyway, that I had ever made. But it was worth it to me. It was my first, and maybe only, big chance. Jay had magic. He was a publicity genius. In retrospect, a big part of my splash onto the scene was Jay's ability to manipulate the media. Three's Company went on the air Tuesday night, March 15th, 1977, and on its first outing was the number three show in America. Happy Days was number one, and Laverne and Shirley was number two. Being the number three rated show in all of TV then was much more meaningful than it is today. The viewers could only choose from ABC, CBS, or NBC. Some weeks we were getting a 46 share, which means that almost half of the entire population watching TV that night during our time slot was watching our show. And America instantly took to my character, Chrissy Snow. She was a lovable, ditzy blonde with a heart of gold and a circuitous route to logic. The reaction was instant. The day after the first show aired, I was flabbergasted by the recognition. Everywhere I went, the supermarket, in my car at a traffic light, the dry cleaners, people would say, "Hey, you're the girl from that new show about three people in an apartment." Chrissy Snow became a living, breathing person to me. I understood her soul, her moral code. In many ways, she was the child I'd never gotten to be. Suddenly, I understood what being a happy child could be like. And it was wonderful. In analyzing the show, I now see that Jack and Janet represented the parents and Chrissy was the child. Chrissy was safe, nurtured, and protected, as if she were in a normal, healthy family, with all the decisions revolving around what's best for the child. In the dysfunctional home of the alcoholic, like the one I came from, or in an abusive environment, everything revolves around the addict or the abuser. The needs and feelings of the rest of the family don't count. The family is as strong as its weakest link. This was my childhood scenario, which accounted for my feelings of inadequacy that had plagued me thus far. I had never felt important as a child. I had always felt less than other people, other children. I took on the shame of my father's disease as though it were my own. I spent my early life trying to figure out how to be a better daughter so Daddy would love me enough to stop drinking. Of course, I was never able to be as good as I needed to be because my father drank alcoholically for 35 years. I tried to be perfect. I tried to excel at everything. Dad once told me that if I got straight A's, he would give me $5. I came home with A's and one A-minus, and he wouldn't pay me. It wasn't good enough. Perfectionism takes its toll. Human beings are never perfect. We are always in a state of learning and hopefully correcting our imperfections. So Chrissy was a chance to do my childhood over. I lived out my real child self for 5 years in front of America. And they got her. They understood her thought process. She would never tell a lie and possessed a soul so pure, so innocent, like that of a darling puppy, that everyone wanted to take care of her. So here I was, co-starring in Three's Company, loved, nurtured, safe, successful. Finally, I was accepted. But something felt wrong. Deep down in my gut, where we all really live, I didn't feel deserving. It all came so fast, so suddenly. Too much attention, too much adulation. I thought my years in therapy had unraveled my confusion. Little did I know that the bulk of the work lay ahead of me. From the beginning of my relationship with Alan, I wanted to marry him. In fact, it had become one of those subjects of conversation that could easily ruin the evening. I loved him enough to commit. Why couldn't he? The reasons, of course, were evident. We had a lot to work out between us, namely our children. But I was naive and talked myself into believing that marriage would solve all our problems. All along, he was adamant that he was never getting married again, nor did he want any more children. Why? I would ask, frustrated. Because marriage made me feel trapped, he told me. I'd feel like I'd have to be home rather than want to be home. Well, I announced dramatically, I plan to be married. I hope it's to you, but if not, I will find someone else. Fine, Alan answered, exhausted. We had been through this same discussion so many times. If one of us didn't end it, we'd wind up in a huge argument. As I look back, I'm astounded by my immaturity. I should have been more evolved in my thinking. Because of my empty threats, Alan continued to hold the power in our relationship, and this made me feel crazy. Landing the part on Three's Company gave me confidence. It took away my desperation. It refocused me. I was no longer destitute. I could live without Alan. I didn't want to, but I knew I could. Somehow, my lack of desperation allowed Alan to relax. I stopped pushing the issue. I began to be comfortable with living together. Financial independence transformed me. When the time is right, I told Alan. In the meantime, it's better like this. I meant it. The big rush was off. We started getting along better. We were enjoying each other again. The fear of pushing emotional buttons that would provoke an argument had dissipated in this one area, lightening the load of emotional baggage somewhat. But discussions about our children were still very flammable. We walked on eggshells in this area and spoke cautiously. But we were moving forward as a couple. We were trying to find peace together in these new and uncharted waters. We were doing the best we could with the information we had at that time. In July 1977, John, Joyce, and I were asked to guest on the Dinah Shore Show. Dinah Show was the hot talk show of the 70s and was watched daily by most Americans who were home in the afternoons. Dinah was romantically involved with Burt Reynolds at that time, and the media wrote incessantly about them because she was so much older than he. After the show, Alan and I went to our favorite restaurant, Le Restaurant, on Melrose Place to have a romantic dinner. I was on cloud nine. The Dinah Show had been great. Three's company was great. My life felt great. It was one of those perfect nights where problems took a backseat and a pervading sense of joy took over. Alan took my hand and said, "I love you, Suzanne. Will you be my wife?" It came so easily. It felt so right. It was time. I wasn't surprised as much as I felt settled, content. "I love you too," I answered. "I would love to have you as my husband." We decided to have a relatively small wedding that autumn in our newly purchased home, a beautiful glass house that sat on the sand overlooking the blue waters of the Pacific Ocean. It had been a phenomenal period for me. I was marrying the love of my life, and my career had skyrocketed beyond my wildest expectations. So far that year, I had been on the covers of 55 national magazines, including one of the highest-selling covers of Newsweek to that date. The same week I planned to marry Alan, 60 Minutes, the most popular news magazine show on television, came to my home to do a feature on me as the next Farrah, the next blonde. I was so busy with personal and professional obligations, I came home on Friday afternoon, November 18th, and found Morley Safer sitting in my living room waiting to interview me. The morning had been so busy that I was running late. Imagine, late for 60 minutes. But this was my new reality. I wanted a perfect wedding, and mostly it was. We invited 80 people, mainly family, with a few business friends. John Ritter, Joyce DeWitt, Norman Fell, and Mickey Ross and Bernie West, who were two of the three producers, all attended. The wedding was to be held upstairs in our living room overlooking the ocean. We constructed a lovely chuppah, a gorgeous canopy of flowers under which the rabbi conducted the ceremony. Above the living room, on the balcony, three sopranos sang Gregorian chants, counterpoint to our friend Alan Bly singing cantorial music downstairs. It was a stormy beach day, but by the time of our ceremony, the sun had broken through and decided to give one of God's great shows. As I walked down the aisle of our living room toward my husband-to-be, the sky turned a magnificent fiery orange of every imaginable shade, which contrasted with the midnight blue of the ocean. Between the golden sunset, the howling winds, the rich sounds of cantorial music, and Gregorian chant, it was the perfect moment I had waited for all my life. Our children, on the other hand, were not so happy. None of them smiled during the ceremony. In fact, they all looked glum. They had tried so hard to divide and conquer, and they had lost that battle. They felt threatened by our union and didn't know where they fit in with Alan and me now being a united front. We should have talked it out with all of them. The wisdom of this escaped me at that time. I should have let them express their feelings and fears. I should have let them air their anger. It was ignorance, or maybe deep down I didn't really want to know how they felt. Perhaps, as with so many other issues in my life, I felt time would heal on its own. By now, John Ritter, Joyce DeWitt, and I were having the time of our lives. The success of the show was heady. By our second season, technically our first season had only been 6 weeks long, we were the number one show on American television, leaving all others in the dust. No other program could get close to our unbelievable success. The three of us were like children, bouncing around the set, laughing, joking, acting like kindergartners. It was conducive to the chemistry. It was what was appealing to viewers. Three kids living in their own apartment, two girls and a guy, and it was non-sexual, but at the same time, very sexual. John's character was constantly groping at Joyce and me, though never actually making any contact. That would change the dynamics. There was an innocence about all of us, yet also a naughtiness. Oh, those kids, people would say. We were the kids. In some weird place in my mind, I finally had a safe family. I love going to work. I love being a hit. I loved being Chrissy. One day, Alan called me at the studio. Guess what, he asked. You've won a People's Choice Award for Favorite Actress in a New Series. The awards ceremony is in 2 weeks, so get yourself a fancy dress. Really? I said, flabbergasted. It was all too much. A People's Choice Award is immensely meaningful because it is voted for by the people in a national poll. I was very excited. I had grown up watching famous people receive awards on these types of shows, but I never dreamed I would be one of them. The big night came, and I felt like a princess stepping out of my limousine. Flashbulbs popped in my face. "Chrissy, Chrissy, we love you," I heard coming in waves from the throngs of people standing behind the red velvet ropes. I floated down the red carpeted entrance in a state of disbelief. How my life had changed. Inside was more glitter and glamour. Jane Fonda, Mary Tyler Moore, Angie Dickinson, Warren Beatty. Everywhere I looked, there was another famous face. And then I heard the magical words. And the winner is Suzanne Summers, favorite actress in a new television series. I kissed Alan, John, and Joyce, and then floated up to the stage. The award was very heavy crystal, and I almost dropped it. The audience laughed. Thank you very much, I said emotionally to the audience. This means so much. My dad always said, get yourself in the middle, Suzanne. Get noticed. Well, I can't do much better than this. Thanks, Dad. I love you all. And I walked off the stage. For all the bad and bitter times, it was my dad from whom I wanted approval. In my moment of triumph, it was my dad who came to my mind. Blood connection is more potent than we can know, and the child within is forever looking for that little pat on the head. I was damn proud of you, my dad said on the phone the next day. His voice was trembling. That's all I ever wanted to hear from you, Dad, I replied. I love you. The People's Choice Award propelled me further forward. The only glitch was that John and I were getting the bulk of the publicity. All the pictures were of John or me, or of John grabbing after me. Joyce had initially shunned publicity, saying she was an actress, not a celebrity, so most of the magazines passed her over. Nevertheless, bits of resentment were brewing. Joyce is an incredibly learned and gifted actress. She had been at the top of her class at UCLA. The network plucked her out of school with a contract after having seen her in a play put on by the respected UCLA Drama School. I felt that Joyce resented my success, and I felt badly, because I liked her. I had taken very few acting lessons. What I didn't know about acting, I learned by watching my two talented colleagues. I was like a sponge. I learned instantly. If you're lucky, maybe once in a successful career you get a character who lives and breathes and gets into the consciousness of the country. It's a creative thrill. Jean Stapleton had it with Edith Bunker. Carol O'Connor had it with Archie Bunker. Lucille Ball had it with Lucy. And now I had Chrissy. It's more than having good writers, although they are integral and important. It's something that clicks in your brain. You know this person better than anyone. In a way, it's like giving birth. The only negative is that sometimes the character can imprison you. An actor can be so identified and beloved in one role that the public doesn't want to see him or her in any other form. Carol O'Connor has never had the same degree of success with any other character as he had with Archie. Nor has Jean Stapleton been able to be anyone we loved as much as Edith. But I wasn't concerned with this. I would have been happy to play Chrissy the rest of my life. I was curious to see how she turned out. What did life experiences do to her? Did she grow and change, or did she remain the same wide-eyed, trusting virgin that she was? Mickey Ross, one of the producers of the show, was my comedy mentor. He was a former Broadway actor who had had moderate success on stage. As the producer head writer on Three's Company, he finally hit the jackpot. Mickey was extremely talented. To this day, he is probably the best comic talent with whom I have ever worked. At the time, he was 60-ish, tanned and great-looking, with wavy silver hair and Mel Gibson blue eyes. To stay in shape, every day he found time to drive to the ocean from the studio and swim vigorously in the salt water for at least a half hour. He was an excellent writer, actor, and director. It was the producer part of his role that was not his forte. Producing requires business sense. He was strictly creative. He had a soothing sound to his voice, and when he was calm, an engaging laugh that was regularly interrupted for a puff on his cigarette. He did have a short fuse, though, and I instinctively knew to avoid provoking him. Mickey understood what I was creating with Chrissy, and he also became protective of the character. "She's right," he'd say when I would protest a line. He was my ally. Mickey gave me more kudos than he did the others because in his mind I was his creation, which eventually contributed to an atmosphere of resentment. Sometimes the air would get thick with tension and unsaid feelings. This was my new and subliminally dysfunctional family. We could never put our feelings on the table because in reality we weren't a real family. We were a bunch of people thrown together, having incredible success, and the stakes were high. None of us were going to mess with that. Mickey would work with me between scenes, during lunch, and even after work. I listened, I learned, I watched. He became like a father to me. I wanted to please him. He was very controlling. If I didn't do a line or a scene perfectly, he'd scold me or he'd look disappointed. I would apologize and then make sure to dig deeper into my soul and feelings to further purify this character. Chrissy walked differently than I did, without any awareness of her body and sexuality. She was a woman child. Men wanted to protect her and have sex with her. Women loved her purity and innocence, and they knew they could trust her. I lived and breathed this character. When in public, I was confused about who the people wanted me to be. I thought they could never love the real me the way they loved Chrissy. And I loved being loved. I wanted to please everyone. Mickey was cool and distant around Alan. Maybe they were too similar. Alan liked Mickey because he understood him. He respected Mickey's talent and appreciated the energy Mickey put into my instant training as a comedic actress. They both had been raised in Eastern European Jewish immigrant households, so they were simpatico, understood each other and what they were about. Still, even though Alan and Mickey seemed to be cut from the same cloth, I always sensed an underlying struggle between them. Alan was the only person who had more control over me than Mickey did. The line between me and Chrissy was becoming blurred for Mickey. There was a strange sexual tension between us, like a father who desires his daughter but knows it's wrong. Alan had what I think Mickey thought he wanted: the woman, the character, and control. With my life suddenly turning topsy-turvy with career demands, I was finding Bonnie, who had been so instrumental in getting me there, now creating an atmosphere of chaos I couldn't deal with. Several times a day, she'd call the rehearsal hall and scream through the phone, "They want you on Hollywood Squares!" "You can't do Hollywood Squares," Alan would say later that night. "Bonnie should be reading scripts and making an overall network deal for specials, movies, and an ongoing series after Three's Company. If you start showing up on game shows, you're going to lose your specialness. You're the star of the number one show in America. Use it as a springboard." But Bonnie came from the world of daytime television, and that's where she had her contacts. I needed someone stronger for a manager, someone with finesse, someone who knew their way around the nighttime big-deal world of prime time, someone like Jay Bernstein. I kept thinking to myself, look what he's done for Farrah Fawcett. I wished I had someone like him advising me. Maybe it was time. It was my first tough decision. Bonnie had to go. "I'm really sorry," I told her when I finally talked to her shortly thereafter. "Please understand. I felt awful and sad. I liked Bonnie, and she was actually gracious about it. Disappointed, but gracious." Jay took over as my manager midway in the second season of Three's Company in 1978. That's when the action really began to go into that phenomenal state. Because Jay received no commission on Three's Company, he was motivated to drum up as much extra work as possible. Now I was busier than ever. He soon put together future deals for me to star in 3 feature films and 2 TV movies of the week for my first hiatus. Every time he had the chance, he talked me up with reporters. "She's the next Farrah," he would tell them. But Jay also knew how to manipulate me by pressing my insecurity buttons. By our second year together, he'd call me at night and say, "You're slipping. Farrah's got 4 covers, Cheryl's got 3 covers, and you only have 2. I'd buy into it and get off the phone, biting my nails, thinking I was about to fall from grace. I still didn't have any sense of me and how much I was worth emotionally or in the marketplace. The momentum around my career took its toll on the set. John Ritter and I had now risen up and above the show itself. During our summer break in 1978, John was doing 2 motion pictures, and I was scheduled to star in 2 TV movies. Our outside careers caused tension with Joyce and also made the producers feel insecure about their ability to control me. Somehow, they did not like that Jay and Alan had so much influence over me. My happy TV family was quietly becoming more and more dysfunctional. For me, it was a familiar scenario.